Now, we're still in the 13th of Romans, but we're in that situation where we have to just keep digging deeper and deeper into the concepts of the meaning of human relationships. Because when you make a statement to love your neighbor as yourself, you open up a whole, in some respects, can of worms, I guess, because you're opening up the whole subject of human relationships and what they mean. What is the attitude that we have toward others? And that includes the attitude toward family, the attitude toward husbands and wives, the attitude toward children, the attitude toward neighbors, toward God Himself. What is it in our human mind that governs the relationship which we have to other people? You have to take into consideration, in all of these relationships, you simply have to take into consideration the psychological factor, the human mind, what's in it. I get very weary of these glowing testimonies to what God has done to our family. And then, and on the one hand, there are many complex factors involved in that. Sometimes the salvation of a parent may be the key to the thing. If the parent's attitudes have been out of order. If the parent has been out of order, then maybe the salvation of the parent will make a difference in the children. But there are just so many complex things, and the problem is that the bulk of Christendom struggles with the problem of human relationships, no matter how spiritual they are. One of the most important concepts I am trying to get across is to be able to be at peace with Christ in the midst of the human struggle. And not that peace should depend on very noble spiritual achievements. Because if you try to achieve peace by being perfect, you're going to have a lot of disappointments. If you think your peace with Christ rests upon you're always doing everything right, you're never going to have peace with Christ. Never. Every day brings its new disorders. You get out of sorts with somebody, they get out of sorts with you. You no sooner get one problem solved than another emerges. It happens with husbands and wives all the time. You get one thing solved, something else happens. If it isn't an interpersonal relationship, it's a material problem. The automobile breaks down. The plumbing falls apart. The roof caves in. Life is a continuing, constant series of problems, and that has to do with personal relationships as well as with things. And one of the problems with this is that Satan loves to stir up the pot. You can take the loveliest group of Christians you've ever met, and sure as the world, Satan will find something to drop in the pot to make trouble. You think everybody's all in peace now, you get a situation leveled out, and you think everybody's at peace, and all of a sudden everybody's in trouble again. Especially with people who have to live together. And you vow, we're never going to do this again, we're never going to say that again, we're never going to be in this position again, and you're right back in it again. In a few days or one day. The only way to make sanity in our lives is to recognize this extremely valuable principle that the process of human living is a continuing series of problems and that the course of human relationships does not run smoothly. Now, I want you to walk on the earth, in the name of Christ, in peace. I want you to be able to face your challenges not in panic, but in tranquility or in practicality. And again, the only way to achieve that kind of stable, tranquil daily life is to recognize that these problems are all part of the normal process. We should not start laying guilt on, probably not on anyone, much less ourselves. When you make somebody else feel guilty, right away you put up a barrier. You may not at all agree with what they're doing. They may be causing you problems. But if you are trying to help them, if you're trying to minister to them for Christ's sake, you dare not put guilt between you. Not everything people do is acceptable. And sometimes the things they do hurt us. And we wish that they wouldn't do it. There are many ways to discuss problems with people without having them go away feeling guilty. And of course, our whole thinking is, well, if we can make them feel guilty, we'll have leverage. Force them to do something. You rarely can press people to do something on the basis of guilt. All you do is raise barriers. Chiefly, I'm concerned about the guilt we put upon ourselves in regard to these problems of our own relations, our own lives and our relations with others. Once again, I go back to the point that there is an infinite variety of combinations, totally innumerable, infinite variety of combinations of mental activity, of attitudes and processes of the mind. And having lived among people for a great many years, I'm not optimistic to think that these problems all get resolved by a spiritual touch. I wish it were that way. We like to think it would be that way, but it isn't. Now, let's take the family situation. Let's take the situation with children, for example. This is where Christian people, Christian parents, go through a great deal of agony and torment and guilt over this matter of the children. So we have to look at many different factors. First of all, the genetic factor of who we marry, whom we marry. I'm going to be very frank to say to you that most people marry without really deeply consulting Christ on it. Even Christian people get blinders on their eyes in that respect, Christian young people. And they want to do what Christ wants, but they hope they can get away with marrying this person that they really love very much. They hope the Lord will let them get away with it, you know. And they're afraid to put fleeces out, even. That's a not too good an idea anyway. The Lord honors our faith, and when we put fleeces out, may not be the best method, but in our younger days, in the faith, we try to find guidance from the Lord that way. But most people are afraid to test the Lord on whether this is the one they should marry or not. When I came to that point, I had a series of tests, which, this is kind of personal, but may illustrate, which would reflect to me the basic character and nature of the intended. And I committed it to the Lord. One of the tests was had to do with patience with my kind of work, because I would have to talking to people, and time was not easily controlled and so forth. And there were some tests there. In fact, one, it was before the Lord, but I had to talk to someone. She had gone around with me on some of these calls, and it was quite extended beyond what I'd anticipated. And I just put it to the Lord. I said, "Now, Lord, this was all necessary. If when I get back to the car she's very impatient with me, I'll just assume that that's one indication that maybe she shouldn't marry me. You know, this is going to be a common thing." When I got back to the car, she was just very much at peace about it, and it's just one of those little indications. I thought, well, that's one step, you know, one indication to me this is the person that I ought to marry, and so forth. So I went through a series of those things. I wasn't trying to put her down. I was just determining whether the Lord wanted me to marry her or not. Naturally, she's a lovely girl. Somebody should marry her, but whether I ought to or not was the question. It wasn't to try and put myself above her or anything else, just to say these are things that were necessary. Now, whether she did the same or not, I don't know. But the point I'm only making is that not very many people do that. I mean, even among Christians, that will go to that length to determine whether this is the person they ought to marry or not. And I sat down with her and told her ahead of time. I said, this is the kind of life I'm going to be living. It's not going to be different. 20 years from now, it'll be the same thing. This is my schedule. This is the way I'm going. I was a little older. I was out of college when I got married. Now, here's the point I have to make to you. However, many people come to Christ after they've been married. If they had known Christ ahead of time, they might have done the same thing. But it was not so. Now what do we have? Well, now we have to take the fragments and live with them. Now, one of the things I was bringing up was the genetic matter. If we marry without consulting Christ, then the genetic thing comes into play. And now you have combinations of genes that shape the character of that young person, that child in the home. And they pick up genes from past generations. And even if you've married in the will of the Lord in a specific sense, you're still going to have genes in the background that create difficulties. There's so much in genetics. You know that. You see children in your family and others that reflect some characteristic of someone a generation or two or three or four back. You say, well, this person is exactly, very much like a grandmother or auntie or uncle or whatever it is. And that's just a fact of life. I wish it were different. It's not going to be waved away with a magic wand. So every child in the home is different, and every child is a product of a genetic background. Now, there is even difficulty if you are marrying in the best possible way. There's still difficulty with genetics. You can't account for who got married in the past generations and why they married and who they married. Now, what is the thing? Well, we're then, when we come to Christ, we come with a situation. We have a set of circumstances. Now, we have a family, or we're going to have a family. And genetics plays a part in their character and their developments. Every one of us must come to Christ and must function in our lives in spite of, as well as because of, the genetic pattern. Everyone has problems. Everyone has some factors in their personality that are troublesome. Maybe it's procrastination, or it's low threshold of temper loss, or it's carelessness about some kind of things in life, about some factors, or it's memory, or, you know, whatever it is. There are all kinds of personality problems we have to confront. So, all right, here we are. We're in a situation. We have a family. We have our problems. If we've come to Christ after marriage or after the family's older, there are things that were mistakes in the past that we made, perhaps in raising the children. Christians make mistakes in raising their children. I've made mistakes in raising mine. We make mistakes. If we had to do over again, we'd like to do things differently. And people become certain kinds of people, and we have to live with them. Now, we're in an environment. We've got children around us. We've got a husband or a wife, or parents, or grandparents, whatever. We've got people around us that are going in every different direction, these personalities. And we're in the middle of it. Now, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to be very intense about our responsibility to straighten everybody out? Are we going to feel that now we are responsible to see to it that everybody becomes a Christian or everybody has a good life or a nice life? If we do that, we're in trouble. We'll never have any peace. But each one of these individuals is responsible personally for their own life. Each one of these children is responsible. You cannot hold the parents responsible for the rest of their lives for the children's, how the children turn out. Sure, parents make mistakes. They do the best they can. There are parents that are just completely irresponsible, but most of the parents, and certainly the people that come and say, I care about what's happened to my children, these are the kind of people who did their best within the limits of their knowledge. Sometimes overprotective, sometimes not protective enough, never really right on. We have the tendency to strike hard when we should be easy and to be easy when we should be hard. One of those classroom problems, the teacher that kind of goes along and a little easygoing and all of a sudden decides to get tough, and that's always at the wrong time. The student they're going to make an example of is always the wrong one to make an example of. It's just life. We're not born with a psychology text in our hands, thank God. We have one trip around. You understand that with every child that you have, they're one trip around. That means to say that whatever your techniques and methodologies for raising children are, you only have that one child once. The next child is different, and the things that apply to that one don't necessarily apply to the next one. Now you may say, well, I'm not married, none of this concerns me. And I'm going to say to you, yes, it concerns you very much, because it has to do with your relationship to your own parents, if they are living, to your family, to your friends, to your husband, wife, whatever, the people around you. Here you are an individual unit. There is a sense in which everyone is an island. Because in the last analysis, whatever you are within yourself. And you have to be that within yourself. And people outside of you can't always help you. Now here you are a unit. Let us say you've come to Christ now. You belong to Him. Now you are surrounded with people. What are you going to do about them? That's the context we're talking in. And I've picked up the idea of children. What are you going to do with these children? In the best of homes, where you've had constant attention to the matter of discipline and care and culture and so on, children go astray. In the best of homes. They go astray because, A, they have genetic factors in them that make them tend to be more unruly than another child. Well, I don't think you can stand before God and say, if I hadn't had these genes, I would be a Christian. Isn't it? They will have to become Christians in their time and wrestle with their personality problems as you have to wrestle with your personality problems. They're going to have to make their own peace with God. You can do everything in your power to help them. But in the end, they're going to have to make it. And after they get to a certain age, almost anything you say to them or anything you do is going to be wrong, except to keep your hands off after a certain age. You have to just back off and leave them to Christ. The cardinal point is that you are an individual and they are individuals. And there is a limit to the family tie factor. Jesus said very pointedly that when he would come into the household picture, there would be division. Because people would get different priorities. And he said the children would be set against the parents, parents against the children. Man's foes would be they of his own household. Jesus' own family reflected that. Here is Jesus Christ himself, whom we would consider the optimum, ultimate, summum bonum of all ministries, right? If anybody should be able to reach anybody, Christ should do it. He didn't reach his own family in many cases. Some of them, yes. His brothers were very hostile to Christ. If anyone had responsibility to bring his own family through, Jesus should have. There are many fine Christian people. There are many ministers whose children have gone astray in spite of what they've done. Now I know the old saw that comes up immediately. Well, if a man doesn't have his own household in order, how can he rule the house of God? Well, you have to understand the Greek context there. He says that the children should be in orderly array. That is, it's the same word I gave to you from Romans 13. Children should be in an orderly relationship. That is to say that the father should call the shots, for example. In terms of the head of the household, or the mother, too, the working together. Now, a father may give all the right instruction and the child not follow it. If the father says to the child, now, you cannot go to that place, and the child slips out surreptitiously and goes to that place, it's not the father's fault. He's done his job. You can't tie a child to the bedpost or to the clothesline. There's a limit to what you can do. You have to recognize that each person is an individual. you do the best you can with what you've got to work with, up to the limits of your knowledge. If you had come to Christ earlier, perhaps you would have married someone else. But why didn't you come to Christ? Perhaps never knew about Christ. We were not presented the truth properly. Then I have to lay it on the shoulders of the ministers. See? A lot of young people have gone astray because they did not have proper help from the minister. So I can't put blame on a person for not having come to Christ earlier. And now you've done the best you could in that context. You become a Christian. You do the best you can in the new context. And with all of that, the children go astray. Well, they're going to have to be left to make their way to Christ. We can give them the word. You can give them instruction. You can point the way. But like they say, you can take the horse to the water, but you can't make him drink. If you did make mistakes in the past and now you mend your ways, you try to do something different, that doesn't work, but you just can't take the blame for that. Of course, the psychologists have in a lot of respects been responsible for laying that out. To the psychologist, there is no such thing as a bad child, only bad parents. You know, that's just a lot of baloney. One of the great problems with the psychologist seeing your child is that they suddenly have put the child over against you, you know. Now the child, all the faults of the child are because you were not the right kind of parent. It's a common attitude. Parents' fault. Well, I'm here to tell you, I've seen enough of all kinds of homes to say that young people from the best of homes go astray. But I've also seen young people from the worst of homes come to Christ. If you may feel that you in one way or another made mistakes or failed, you commit that to Christ, say, well, Lord, you're going to have to help them anyway. In the end, they're going to have to come to you on their own. All right, now comes the issue, of course. Well, if we pray for them, they're going to be saved. Not necessarily. Paul said something to the jailkeeper in Philippi. He said, what must I do to be saved? And they said, well, you do this and you will be saved and your house. Paul did not say this is going to be true of every Christian. It's a great text to preach on, but Paul did not include a promise that everybody's household would be saved. Just because he made that statement to the Philippian jailer. I don't know the conditions under which he said it to him. But we have no right to take that and say automatically if you pray, people will become saved. There is purpose in praying for them, yes, because God has many things that he can do to encourage them to come to him, or perhaps he lets circumstances occur in their lives that will draw them to him. But in the last analysis, the decision is theirs. But you have some bright testimony from somebody that gets up and says, oh, I prayed for my children. They're all saved now because I prayed for them. Well, that's a questionable thing. And I know many Christian parents who have prayed for their young people and they didn't become saved, at least in the immediate future. And I cannot say that one is more holy than the other. I can't say one Christian parent is better than another or more faithful than another or anything else. I've just seen what I see in the whole of Christendom is the great mix. You have fine Christian parents whose children go astray. You have parents who are not Christians at all, whose children all follow Christ. You have non-Christian parents who have raised fine families. You see all that mix that is there. And all you can do is see yourself as an individual caught in the circumstances of your lives and doing the best you can in the midst of those circumstances. And be at peace about it. Turn it over to the Lord. The Lord may himself not be successful in bringing your young people to himself any more than he was successful bringing his own brothers and sisters through. Because there's a limit. If all we had to do was snap our fingers and people would be saved, then we'd all be a society of puppets. We're not puppets. We have our choices. You're young people. Your own children have choices to make. But now all that I've said here goes for other family relationships. You pray for them. Try to behave yourselves with them in terms of being a good example of Christ. You don't compromise any decision, any choice you make contrary to Christ for the sake of placating a relative is a bad choice. A certain couple had some guests, relatives, in their home. They thought that the guests were of another religion. And so instead of going to church, they stayed home to entertain the guests because they thought they were of another faith and didn't want to offend them. It was a bad decision. Later, as the people were leaving, they found out that they would have very much wanted to go to church but didn't want to offend the host and hostess. I've always said, don't placate relatives or guests or anything else by offending Christ. If your habit is to go to a meeting, don't ever stay home because you've got guests coming. Say, this is night, I go to a meeting. You want to come with me? Fine. You want to stay here, the house is yours. And you say, well, that's not very hospitable. Well, I think we have to put Christ ahead of hospitality in that case. If you feel that that's where I want you to be. I don't say that everybody has to go to a meeting all the time. But if you would normally go, let them know that. Love to have you here, but Sunday we go to church. You want to come along with us? Fine. Don't stay home just for that. Now, this whole problem would have been resolved if these people had just followed that principle and said to these people, well, you can come with us or not. So you stand firm for principle. What you believe is right, whether it offends them or doesn't offend them, and you'll come out better. Do what you feel in your heart is the best thing to do in any given situation. Don't act in terms of what you think their reactions will be. That's true with your children, friends, relatives, anybody. I've always said it, learn to act, not react. You be in charge. You do what you believe in your heart God wants you to do, and let the chips fall where they may. You may not always know what to do. You may be striking out blindly, but do what you think, in principle, is the right thing to do. And trust Christ for the rest. So, you will have bad moments in your relationships to others. You'll make mistakes. You'll offend people. You ask forgiveness, and you go on. If you've done something yourself to offend someone, and you find out about it, you go to them and straighten it out. You weed the garden. Keep the garden weeded. Paul says it here in Hebrews, or rather in Romans, as much as lies within you, live at peace with all. All you can do is function the best way you can, work around the problem. Work around it. There are a lot of angles to that. I understand it's not quite that simple. But in principle, you've got, actually, as I've said in terms of husbands and wives, and I have a wife, for example, who comes about her marriage and things are pretty difficult. So I always say, well, you've got three options. You can leave. You can try to straighten things out, integrate it, or you can just be low-key. Stay together and be low-key. I said, if you're not able to leave, don't fuss about it. So don't keep going over in your head. For a lot of women, it's not practical. They can't, you know, to leave. And it's not usually your best choice, but it's sometimes a necessary choice. But if it's not going to be a possible choice, then quit mulling it over in your mind. Second option is to try to integrate things. Well, that can be a disheartening situation. By the time people come to me, they've already been through so much that they just haven't got the heart to try to do any more. You know, they've already been through it. It's just a terrible thing to go to some marriage counselor, some pastor who brightly suggests, well, let's try this, you know. You know, I've already worn out all the options. One thing I make a very firm point about, I never recommend for people to do something which is beyond their capacity to do. It's not up to me to decide what a person ought to be able to put up with. Pastor can easily say, well, you have to bear with this for Christ's sake. Maybe I couldn't even bear with it. I don't know. I might recommend it, but I can't insist. You know, if you have to leave, leave. But anyway, to try to integrate now, after all these years, maybe just more than the person can really handle. So the third option is probably the practical one. Stay in there low-key. Don't try to straighten the other person out. It's the constant expectation that I can put this marriage together that keeps the thing stirred up. Barring some miracle, it probably won't be a united marriage. We just have to stay together. Work around it. Many different ways that can be done. But to try and keep always integrating it when the other person isn't willing to integrate it may be just disheartening. That's true with friends, friendships too. All the people you relate to, with children, with your young people. The cardinal point is this. You paddle your own canoe and keep it afloat as best you can. And you let them paddle their canoe and trust Christ. Leave them alone. That's what I meant by this thing of people who get so intense about saving their families and feeling such a keen responsibility. Well, you remember this example. Jesus didn't even get his own family through. Why? Because people are individuals, and there's a limit to what God can do and a limit to what anybody can do. So just do what you think is best to do for yourself, for your sake, for Christ's sake, and leave them alone. Now, I'm not talking about little children who have to be. That's a different thing. It's a different story.
Dave?
Yes.
Well, it's been pretty popular lately with married couples, so I never went, but it's marriage encounter. And the whole idea there is to communicate your problems and stuff, and people go on and they say it's great.
I really would not want to evaluate it because I haven't been one. In principle, the problem is forcing, in an artificial situation, a rehabilitation factor. I'm not sure I understand why it couldn't be done at home as easily. The problem usually between married couples, and communication is a very popular label, because you can always put everything under that. You know, or we just don't communicate. The problem with almost any married situation is selfishness. When each person in the team wants to do what is best for the other person, a lot of these things, just these problems melt away. I really think it sets up an artificial situation, to be honest with you. I think really we like to make our problems sophisticated by giving them labels when the basic issue is what are we willing to pay for affection. People come into marriage with the idea that they will each have their little bailiwick and they'll live under the same roof. You can't do that. If you don't want to integrate with somebody, don't get married, see? We spend 20 or so years of our lives living our own thing, see? Not when we think, well, now I'll marry this person, we'll be two people doing our own thing. Well, that's just stupid. The problem is the same as you have with an organ transplant. The biggest problem in organ transplant is not the knitting of the tissues, it's the rejection of a mass of protein by the antibodies. The antibodies are in you to reject foreign matter. So they have to reduce the antibody reaction, and in so doing, they also lower resistance to other kinds of infections and disease and so forth. And the net result is that people die from side effects. They'll die from pneumonia because the antibodies aren't adequate to handle it since they've had to reduce their action in order to receive the foreign mass of protein. Now, in the marriage situation, you've spent 20 or so years living for yourself. All of a sudden, you have to integrate another element. It isn't just standing side by side. It's integrating. Give and take. Cooperation. Compatibility. All of these things. Priorities. All of these things come into play. The root issue for Christian couples is, what does Christ want? That's the root issue. There's no use going off to the mountains just to ask Christ what he wants in your lives. If a young couple or a couple would just get together and say, "Now, we've got these problems. Let's ask Christ what he wants." That's the difference between living in the flesh and living in the spirit. It's a simple matter. It's not a mystical thing. Living in the spirit means simply that you ask Christ what he wants in the matter. You have a problem in your home. One person wants one thing, one person wants another. You come together and you pray. And you say, "Lord, what do you want in this matter?" Now, there are so many different angles to this. One member of the team who is strongly concerned about acquiring material possessions and another person that isn't, you've got a priority problem. They may both be Christians and still have a priority problem. One person there has their heart set on going to Mammoth for the vacation. The other one wants to go to the sea. Now you've got a simple matter of who wins out, and maybe you ought to ask Christ what he would like in your vacation situation. Now, you say, "Well, I have an unsaved husband or unsaved wife." I can't do that. That's true. That's what I've been trying to tell you. Then you have to paddle your own canoe. And you have to just do what you feel Christ wants you to do and not try to drag the other person into it. So all the sophisticated counseling techniques and encounter techniques and everything will never be of any value whatever unless both have decided in advance that they want to do what Christ wants. It is true people need often guidance, but usually, and I've been in this counseling business for a long time, sitting in offices with both and each and so forth, generally speaking, all the problems they had could be resolved by that simple point. But usually when people come for counseling, whoever it is that sets it up is just hoping that the counsel will take their side. I don't like to counsel with couples together. Sounds like a nice idea, but it never works. Why? Because usually there are angles on both sides of the question. If the wife has set the counseling situation up and I should take the husband's side at all, then I'm disloyal to her. If I take her side, I'm ganging up on the husband. And nobody really freely speaks their mind anyway, so I like to see each of them separately. But usually it boils down to the simple issue of being willing to blend their lives, to integrate, to give and take, to merge. And the only way Christians can successfully merge is that both of them want to do what Christ wants in the matter. That people want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to be married and single at the same time. They want to live under the same roof, enjoy all the advantages of marriage, and yet have all the liberties of the single life. When you take a person into your life, the only way you can successfully function with that is that you integrate. Now, if you are married to someone you can't integrate with, they're not Christians or their priorities are different, then all you can do is do the best you can to follow Christ and try to be low-key about the integration. And the net issue here is you are an individual striving to do the best you can to follow Christ. You are surrounded by people, willing and unwilling, compatible and incompatible. All you can do is walk among them in kindness and sensitivity and seek to do what Christ wants you to do and function in as much peace as possible with those around you. The worst way to handle your relationships is to try to straighten people out. Unless you've got a youngster you can straighten out with a peach switch. Once you get beyond the peach switch stage, you're going to have a pretty tough time straightening anybody out. So don't try. Well, I better stop.